Cut to a silvery delta-winged aircraft in flight. Stub wings, pointed nose, and a shortage of windows proclaim it to be an unmanned drone. A single large engine in its tail thrusts it along, exhaust nozzle glowing cherry red. Trackless wastes unwind below it as the viewpoint, a chase plane, carefully climbs over the drone to capture a clear view of the upper fuselage. Voiceover. The disc is vast, so huge that it defies sanity. Some estimates give it the surface area of more than a billion Earths. Exploration by conventional means is futile, hence the deployment of the NP-101 Persephone drone, here making a proving flight over landmass F-42. The NP-101 is a reconnaissance derivative of the nuclear-powered D-SLAM Pluto missile that forms the backbone of our post-move deterrent force. It is slower than a strategic D-SLAM, but much more reliable. While D-SLAM is designed for a quick, fiery dash into Soviet territory, the NP-101 is designed to fly long-duration missions that map entire continents. On a typical deployment, the NP-101 flies outward at thrice the speed of sound for nearly a month. Traveling 50,000 miles a day, it penetrates a million miles into the unknown before it turns and flies homeward. Its huge mapping cameras record 2 images every 1,000 seconds, and its sophisticated digital computer records a variety of data from its sensor suite, allowing us to build up a picture of parts of the disk that our ships would take years or decades to reach. With resolution down to the level of a single nautical mile, the NP-101 program has been a resounding success, allowing us to map whole new worlds that it would take us years to visit in person. At the end of its mission, the NP-101 drops its final film capsule and flies out into the middle of an uninhabited ocean to ditch its spent nuclear reactor safely far from home. Cut to a bullseye diagram. The center is a black circle with a star at its heart. Around it is a circular platter of roughly the same proportions as a 45 RPM single. Voiceover. A rough map of the disk. Here is the area we have explored to date, using the NP-101 program. A dot, a little larger than a grain of sand, lights up on the face of the single. That dot of light is a million kilometers in radius, 5 times the distance that used to separate our old Earth from its moon. To cross the radius of the disk, an NP-101 would have to fly at Mach 3 for almost 10 years. We aren't even sure exactly where the center of that dot lies on the disk. Our highest-sounding rocket, the Nova Orion Block 2, can barely rise 2 degrees above the plane of the disk before crashing back again. Here is the scope of our knowledge of our surroundings, derived from the continental-scale mapping cameras carried by Project Orion. A salmon-pink area almost 1/2 inch in diameter lights up around the red sand grain on the face of the single. Of course, cameras at an altitude of 100,000 miles can't look down on new continents and discern signs of communist infiltration. At best, they can listen for radio transmissions and perform spectroscopic analyses of the atmospheric gases above distant lands, looking for contaminants characteristic of industrial development such as chlorofluorocarbons and nitrogen oxides. This leaves us vulnerable to unpleasant surprises. Our long-term strategic analyses imply that we are almost certainly not alone on the disk. In addition to the communists, we must consider the possibility that whoever built this monstrous structure, clearly one of the wonders of the universe, might also live here. We must contemplate their motives for bringing us to this place. And then there are the aboriginal cultures discovered on continents F-29 and F-364, both now placed under quarantine. If some landmasses bear aboriginal inhabitants, we may speculate that they, too, have been transported to the disk in the same manner as ourselves, for some as-yet-unknown purpose. It is possible that they are genuine Stone Age dwellers, or that they are the survivors of advanced civilizations that did not survive the transition to this environment. What is the possibility that there exists on the disk one or more advanced alien civilizations that are larger and more powerful than our own? And would we recognize them as such if we saw them? How can we go about estimating the risk of our encountering hostile little green men, now that other worlds are in range of even a well-equipped sailboat, much less the Savannah-class nuclear-powered exploration ships? Astronomers Carl Sagan and Daniel Drake estimate the probability is high, so high, in fact, that they believe there are several such civilizations out there. We are not alone. We can only speculate about why we might have been brought here by the abductors, but we can be certain that it is only a matter of time before we encounter an advanced alien civilization that may well be hostile to us. This briefing film will now continue with an overview of our strategic preparations for first contact and the scenarios within which we envisaged this contingency arising, with specific reference to the Soviet Union as an example of an unfriendly ideological superpower. Tenure Track. After 2 weeks, Maddie is sure she's going mad. She and Bob have been assigned a small prefabricated house, not much more than a shack, although it has electricity and running water, on the edge of town. He's been drafted into residential works, but to work erecting more buildings, and this is the nearest thing to a success they've had, because after a carefully controlled protest, his status has been corrected, from just another set of unskilled hands to trainee surveyor. A promotion of which he is terribly proud, evidently taking it as confirmation that they've made the right move by coming here. Maddie, meanwhile, has a harder time finding work. The district hospital is fully staffed. They don't need her, won't need her until the next shipload of settlers arrives, unless she wants to pack up her bags and go tramping around isolated ranch settlements in the outback. In a year's time, the governor has decreed they'll establish another town-scale settlement, inland, near the mining encampments on the edge of the Hoover Desert. Then they'll need medics to staff the new hospital. But for now, she's a spare wheel, because Maddie is a city girl by upbringing and disposition, and not inclined to take a job hiking around the bush if she can avoid it. She spends the first week, and then much of the second, mooching around town, trying to find out what she can do. She's not the only young woman in this predicament. While there's officially no unemployment, and the colony's dirigist administration finds plenty of hard work for idle hands, there's also a lack of openings for ambulance crew, or, indeed, much of anything else she can do. Career-wise, it's like a trip into the 1950s. Young, female and ambitious, lots of occupations simply don't exist out here on the fringe, and many others are closed or inaccessible. Everywhere she looks, she sees mothers shepherding implausibly large flocks of toddlers, their guardians pinch-faced from worry and exhaustion. Bob wants kids, although Maddie's not ready for that yet. But the alternatives on offer are limited. Eventually, Maddie takes to going through the Help Wanted ads on the bulletin board outside City Hall. Some of them are legit, and at least a few are downright peculiar. One catches her eye. Field assistant wanted for biological research. I wonder, she thinks, and goes in search of a door to bang on. When she finds the door, raw wood just beginning to bleach in the strong colonial sunlight, and bangs on it, John Martin opens it and blinks quizzically into the light. Hello, he asks. You were advertising for a field assistant. She stares at him. He's the entomologist, right? She remembers his hands on the telescope on the deck of the ship. The voyage itself is already taking on the false pattern of romance in her memories, compared to the dusty present it has delivered her to. I was. Oh, yes, yes. Do come in. He backs into the house, another of these identikit shacks, colonial, family, for the use of, and offers her a seat in what used to be the living room. It's almost completely filled by a work table and a desk and a tall wooden chest of sample drawers. There's an odd, musty smell, like old cobwebs and leaky demijohns of formalin. John shuffles around his den, vaguely disordered by the unexpected shock of company. There's something touchingly cute about him, like the subjects of his studies, Maddie thinks. Sorry about the mess. I don't get many visitors. So, do you have any relevant experience? She doesn't hesitate. None whatsoever, but I'd like to learn. She leans forward. I qualified as a paramedic before we left. At college I was studying biology, but I had to drop out midway through my second year. I was thinking about going to medical school later, but I guess that's not going to happen here. Anyway, the hospital here has no vacancies, so I need to find something else to do. What exactly does a field assistant get up to?
Get sore feet.
He grins lopsidedly.
Did you do any lab time? Field work?
Maddie nods hesitantly, so he drags her meager college experiences out of her before he continues.
I've got a whole continent to explore and only one set of hands. We're spread thin out here. Luckily, NSF budgeted to hire me an assistant. The assistant's job is to be my man Friday, to help me cart equipment about, take samples, help with basic lab work. Very basic. And so on. Oh, and if they're interested in entomology, botany, or anything else remotely relevant, that's a plus. There aren't many unemployed life sciences people around here, funnily enough. Have you had any chemistry?
Some, Maddie says cautiously. I'm no biochemist. She glances round the crowded office curiously. What are you meant to be doing?
He sighs. A primary survey of an entire continent. Nobody but nobody even bothered looking into the local insect ecology here. There are virtually no vertebrates, birds, lizards, what have you. But back home, there are more species of beetle than everything else put together, and this place is no different. Did you know nobody's even sampled the outback 50 miles inland of here? We're doing nothing but throwing up shacks along the coastline and open-cast quarries a few miles inland. There could be anything in the interior. Absolutely anything.
When he gets excited, he starts gesticulating, Maddie notices, waving his hands around enthusiastically. She nods and smiles, trying to encourage him.
A lot of what I'm doing is the sort of thing they were doing in the 18th and 19th centuries. Take samples, draw them, log their habitat and dietary habits, see if I can figure out their life cycle, try and work out who's kissing cousins with what, build a family tree. Oh, I also need to do the same with vegetation, you know. And they want me to keep close watch on the other disks around Lucifer. Keep an eye out for signs of sapience, whatever that means. I figure there's a bunch of leftovers in the astronomical community who feel downright insulted that whoever built this disk and brought us here didn't land on the White House lawn and introduce themselves. I'd better tell you right now, there's enough work here to occupy an army of zoologists and botanists for a century. You can get started on a PhD right here and now if you want. I'm only here for 5 years, but my successor should be okay about taking on an experienced RA. The hard bit is going to be maintaining focus. I can sort you out a subsistence grant from the Governor-General's Discretionary Fund and get NSF to reimburse him, but it won't be huge. Would $20 Truman a week be enough?
Maddie thinks for a moment. Truman dollars, the local scrip, aren't worth a whole lot. But there's not much to spend them on. And Bob's earning for both of them anyway. And a PhD. That could be my ticket back to civilization, couldn't it?
I guess so, she says, feeling a sense of vast relief.
So there's something she's useful for besides raising the next generation after all. She tries to set aside the visions of herself, distinguished and not too much older, gratefully accepting a professor's chair at an Ivy League university. When do I start? On the beach. Misha's first impressions of the disturbingly familiar alien continent are of an oppressively humid heat and the stench of decaying jellyfish. The Sergei Korolev floats at anchor in the river estuary, a huge, streamlined visitor from another world. Stubby fins stick out near the waterline, like a seaplane with clipped wings. Gigantic Kuznetsov atomic turbines in pods ride on booms to either side of its high-ridged back, either side of the launch recovery catapults for its parasite MiG fighter bombers, aft of the broad curve of the Akranoplans Bridge. Near the waterline, a boat bay is open. A naval Spetsnaz team is busy loading their kit into the landing craft that will ferry them to the small camp on the beach. Misha, who stands just above the waterline, turns away from the giant ground-effect ship and watches his commander, who is staring inland with a faint expression of worry.
"Those trees, awfully close, aren't they?"
Gagarin says, with the carefully studied stupidity that saw him through the first dangerous years after his patron Khrushchev's fall. "That is indeed what Captain Kirov is taking care of," replies Gorodin, playing his role of foil to the Colonel General's sardonic humour. And indeed, shadowy figures in olive-green battle dress are stalking in and out of the trees, carefully laying tripwires and screamers in an arc around the beachhead. He glances to the left, where a couple of sailors with assault rifles stand guard, eyes scanning the jungle.
"I wouldn't worry unduly, sir.
I'll be happier when the outer perimeter is secure. And when I've got a sane explanation for this, for the Comrade General's secretary..."
Gagarin's humour evaporates. He turns and walks along the beach toward the large tent that's already gone up to provide shelter from the heat of noon. The bar of solid sunlight, what passes for sunlight here, is already at maximum length, glaring like a rod of white-hot steel that impales the disk. Some of the more superstitious call it the axle of heaven. Part of Gorodin's job is to discourage such non-materialist backsliding. The tent awning is pegged back. Inside it, Gagarin and Misha find Major Suvorov and academician Borisovich leaning over a map. Already the scientific film crew, a bunch of dubious civilians from TASS, is busy in a corner preparing cans for shooting.
"Ah, Oleg, Mikhail," Gagarin summons up a professionally photogenic smile. "Getting anywhere?"
Borisovich, a slight stooped-shouldered type who looks more like a janitor than a world-famous scientist, shrugs.
"We were just talking about going along to the archaeological site, General. Perhaps you'd like to come, too."
Misha looks over his shoulder at the map. It's drawn in pencil, and there's an awful lot of white space on it. But what they've surveyed so far is disturbingly familiar in outline. Familiar enough to have given them all a number of sleepless nights even before they came ashore. Someone has scribbled a dragon coiling in a particularly empty corner of the void.
"How large is the site?"
asks Yuri.
"Don't know, sir."
Major Suvorov grumps audibly, as if the lack of concrete intelligence on the alien runes is a personal affront.
"We haven't found the end of it yet, but it matches what we know already."
"The aerial survey,"
Mikhail coughs delicately.
"If you'd let me have another flight, I could tell you more, General. I believe it may be possible to define the city limits narrowly, but the trees make it hard to tell."
"I'd give you the flight, if only I had the aviation fuel," Gagarin explains patiently.
"A chopper can burn its own weight in fuel in a day of surveying, and we have to haul everything out of here from Arkhangelsk. In fact, when we go home, we're leaving most of our flight-ready aircraft behind, just so that on the next trip out we can carry more fuel."
"I understand,"
Mikhail doesn't look happy. As Oleg Ivanovich says, we don't know how far it reaches, but I think when you see the runes, you'll understand why we need to come back here. Nobody's found anything like this before.
Old capitalist man, Misha smiles thinly. I suppose.
Presumably, Borisovich shrugs. Whatever, we need to bring archaeologists and a mass spectroscope for carbon dating, and other stuff.
His face wrinkles unhappily.
They were here back when we would still have been living in caves.
Except we weren't,
Gagarin says under his breath. Misha pretends not to notice. By the time they leave the tent, the Marines have gotten the Korolev's two BRDMs ashore. The big balloon-tired armored cars sit on the beach like monstrous amphibians freshly emerged from some primeval sea. Gagarin and Gorodin sit in the back of the second vehicle with the academician and the film crew. The lead BRDM carries their Spetsnaz escort team. They maintain a dignified silence as the convoy rumbles and squeaks across the beach, up the gently sloping hillside, then down toward the valley with the ruins. The armored cars stop. The doors open. Everyone is relieved by the faint breeze that cracks the oven heat of the interior. Gagarin walks over to the nearest ruin, remnants of a wall, waist high, and stands, hands on hips, looking across the wasteland.
Concrete, says Borisovich, holding up a lump of crumpled, not stone from the foot of the wall for Yuri to see. Indeed, Gagarin nods. Any idea what this was?
Not yet.
The camera crew is already filming, heading down a broad boulevard between rows of crumbling foundations.
Only the concrete has survived, and it's mostly turned to limestone. This is old.
The first cosmonaut walks around the stump of wall and steps down to the foundation layer behind it, looking around with interest.
Interior column here. Four walls. They're worn down, aren't they? This stuff that looks like a red stain. Rebar? Found any intact ones? Again, not yet, sir, says Borisovich. We haven't looked everywhere yet, but...
Indeed.
Gagarin scratches his chin idly.
Am I imagining it, or are the walls all lower on that side?
He points north, deeper into the sprawling maze of overgrown rubble.
You're right, sir. No theory for it, though.
You don't say.
Gagarin walks north from the five-sided building's ruin, looks around.
This was a road? Once, sir. It was 9 meters wide. There seems to have been derelict ground between the houses, if that's what they were, and the road itself.
9 meters, you say?
Gorodin and the academician hurry to follow him as he strikes off up the road.
Interesting stonework here, don't you think, Misha?
Yes, sir. Interesting stonework.
Gagarin stops abruptly and kneels.
Why is it cracked like this?
Hey, there's sand down there.
And, glass?
Looks like it's melted.
Ah, trinitite.
Sir?
Borisovich leans forward.
That's odd.
What is?
Asks Misha. But before he gets a reply, both Gagarin and the researcher are up again and off toward another building.
Look, the north wall.
Gagarin's found another chunk of wall, this one a worn stump that's more than a meter high. He looks unhappy.
Sir, are you all right?
Misha stares at him. Then he notices the academician is also silent and looking deeply perturbed.
What's wrong?
Gagarin extends a finger, points at the wall.
You can just see him if you look close enough. How long would it take to fade, Mikhail? How many years have we missed them by?
The academician licks his lips.
At least 2,000 years, sir. Concrete cures over time, but it takes a very long time indeed to turn all the way to limestone. And then there's the weathering process to take account of. But the surface erosion... Yes, that could fix the image from the flash. Perhaps. I'd need to ask a few colleagues back home. What's wrong?
The political officer repeats, puzzled. The first cosmonaut grins humorlessly.
Better get your Geiger counter, Misha, and see if the runes are still hot. Looks like we're not the only people on the disk with a geopolitical problem.
Been here before. Brundle has finally taken the time to pull Gregor aside and explain what's going on. Gregor is not amused.
Sorry you walked into it cold, says Brundle,
but I figured it would be best for you to see for yourself. He speaks with a Midwestern twang and a flatness of affect that his colleagues sometimes mistake for signs of an underlying psychopathology.
See what in particular?
Gregor asks sharply.
What in particular?
Gregor tends to repeat himself, changing only the intonation when he's disturbed. He's human enough to recognize it as a bad habit, but still finds it difficult to suppress the reflex. Brundle pauses on the footpath, looks around to make sure there's nobody within earshot. The mall is nearly empty today, and only a humid breeze stirs the waters on the pool.
Tell me what you think.
Gregor thinks for a moment, then summons up his full command of the local language. It's good practice.
The boys in the big house are asking for a CAB. This means someone's pulled his head out of his ass for long enough to realize they've got worse things to worry about than being shafted by the Soviets. Something's happened to make them realize they need a policy for dealing with the abductors. This is against doctrine. We need to do something about it fast before they start asking the right questions. Something's shaken them up. Something secret. Some human source from the wrong side of the curtain, perhaps. Could it be that man Gordievsky? But they haven't quite figured out what being here means.
Sagan, does his presence mean what I think it does?
Yes,
Brundle says tersely.
Oh, dear.
A reflex trips, and Gregor takes off his spectacles and polishes them nervously on his tie before replacing them.
Is it just him, or does it go further?
He leaves the rest of the sentence unspoken by convention. Is it just him you think we'll have to silence?
Further.
Brundle tends to talk out of the side of his mouth when he's agitated, and from his current expression, Gregor figures he's really upset.
Sagan and his friends at Cornell have been using the Arecibo dish to listen to the neighbors. This wasn't anticipated. Now they're asking for permission to beam a signal at the nearest of the other disks. Straight up, more or less, talk to us. Unfortunately, Sagan is well known, which is why he caught the attention of our nominal superiors. Meanwhile, the Soviets have found something that scared them. CIA didn't hear about it through the usual assets. They contacted the State Department via the embassy. They're that scared.
Brundle pauses a moment.
Sagan and his buddies don't know about that, of course. Why has nobody shot them already?
Gregor asks coldly.
Brundle shrugs. They pulled the plug on their funding just in time. If we shot them as well, someone might notice. Everything could go non-linear while we were trying to cover it up. You know the problem. This is a semi-open society, inadequately controlled. A bunch of astronomers get together on their own initiative, academic conference, whatever, and decide to spend a couple of $1,000s of research grant money from the NIST to establish communications with the nearest disk. How are we supposed to police that kind of thing? Shut down all their radio telescopes. at gunpoint if necessary, but I figure a power cut or a congressional committee would be just as effective as leverage.
Perhaps, but we don't have the Soviets' resources to work with. Anyway, that's why I dragged Sagan in for the CAB. It's a Potemkin village, you understand, to convince everybody he contacted that something is being done, but we're going to have to figure out how to shut him up.
Sagan is the leader of the Talk to Us Alien Gods crowd, I take it.
Yes.
Well, Gregor considers his next words carefully. Assuming he's still clean and uncontaminated, we can still turn him, or we can ice him. If we're going to turn him, we need to do it convincingly, full terrorization. And we'll need to come up with a convincing rationale. Use him to evangelize the astronomical community into shutting up or herring off in the wrong direction, like Heisenberg and the Nazi nuclear weapons program.
He snaps his fingers.
Why don't we tell him the truth? At least something close enough to it to confuse the issue completely.
Because he's a member of the Federation of American Scientists and he won't believe anything we tell him without independent confirmation.
Brundle mutters through one side of his mouth. That's the trouble with using a government agency as our cover story.
They walk in silence for a minute. I think it would be very dangerous to underestimate him, says Gregor. He could be a real asset to us, but uncontrolled, he's very dangerous. If we can't silence him, we may have to resort to physical violence. And with the number of colonies they've already seeded, we can't be sure of getting them all.
Itemize the state of their understanding,
Brundle says abruptly.
I want a reality check. I'll tell you what's new after you run down the checklist.
Okay. Gregor thinks for a minute. Let us see. What everyone knows is that between 03:15 and 12 seconds and 13 seconds Zulu time on October 2nd, 62, all the clocks stopped, the satellites went away, the star map changed, 19 airliners and 46 ships in transit ended up in terminal trouble, and they found themselves transferred from a globe in the Milky Way galaxy to a disk which we figure is somewhere in the Lesser Magellanic Cloud. Meanwhile, the Milky Way galaxy, we assume that's what it is, has changed visibly. Lots of metal-depleted stars, signs of macroscopic cosmic engineering, that sort of thing. The public explanation is that the visitors froze time, skinned the Earth, and plated it over the disk. Luckily, they're still bickering over whether the explanation is Minsky's copying, hypothesis, or that guy Moravetz and his digital simulation theory. Indeed. Brundle kicks at a paving stone idly.
Now, what is your forward analysis?
Well, sooner or later, they're going to turn dangerous. They have the historic predisposition toward teleological errors, to believe in a giant omnipotent creator and a purpose to their existence. If they start speculating about the intentions of a transcendent intelligence, it's likely they'll eventually ask whether their presence here is symptomatic of God's desire to probe the circumstances of its own birth. After all, we have evidence of how many technological species on the disk? 10 million? 12? Replicated many times in some cases. They might put it together with their concept of manifest destiny and conclude that they are, in fact, doomed to give birth to God, which is an entirely undesirable conclusion for them to reach from our point of view. Teleologists being bad neighbors, so to speak.
Yes, indeed,
Brundle says thoughtfully, then titters quietly to himself for a moment.
This isn't the first time they've avoided throwing around H-bombs in bulk. That's unusual for primate civilizations. If they keep doing that, they could be dangerous.
Dangerous is relative, says Brundle. He titters again. Things move inside his mouth.
Don't do that,
Gregor snaps. He glances round instinctively, but nothing happens.
You're jumpy, Brundle frowns. Stop worrying so much. We don't have much longer here.
Are we being ordered to move, or to prepare a sterilization strike?
Not yet.
Brundle shrugs. We have further research to continue with before a decision is reached.
The Soviets have made a discovery. Their crude exploration program, the Korolev, looked out.
They...
Gregor tenses.
What did they find?
He knows about the big nuclear-powered Ekranoplan, the Dragon of the Caspian, searching the seven oceans for new worlds to conquer. He even knows about the small fleet they're trying to build at Arkhangelsk, the ruinous expense of it.
But this is new. What did they find?
Brundle grins humorlessly.
They found ruins.
Then they spent another 8 weeks mapping the coastline. They've confirmed what they found. They sent the State Department photographs, survey details, the lot. Brundle gestures at the Cuban War Monument, the huge granite column dominating the mall, its shadow pointing toward the capital.
They found Washington, D.C., in ruins. 140,000 miles that way.
He points due north.
They're not total idiots, and it's the first time they found one of their own species transfer cognates. They might be well on their way to understanding the truth. Luckily, our comrades in Moscow have that side of the affair under control, but they communicated their discovery to the CIA before it could be suppressed, which raises certain headaches. We must make sure that nobody here asks why. So I want you to start by dealing with Sagan.
Collecting Jar. It's noon, and the rippling heat haze turns the horizon to fog in the distance. Maddie tries not to move too much. The cycads cast imperfect shadows, and she can feel the Venetian blinds of light burning into her pale skin. She sighs slightly as she hefts the heavy canvas sample bag out of the back of the Land Rover. John will be needing it soon, once he's finished photographing the mock termite nests. It's their third field trip together, their farthest dash into the outback, and she's already getting used to working with John. He's surprisingly easy to get on with because he's so absorbed in his work that he's refreshingly free of social expectations. If she didn't know better, she could almost let her guard down and start thinking of him as a friend, not an employer. The heat makes her mind drift. She tries to remember what sparked her most recent quarrel with Bob, but it seems so distant and irrelevant now. Like home. Like Bob arguing with her father. Like their hurried courthouse wedding and furtive emigration board hearing. All that makes sense now is the stifling heat, the glare of not sunlight. John working with his camera out in the noonday sun, where only mad dogs and Englishmen dare go. Ah, it was the washing. Who was going to do the washing while Maddie was away on the 2-day field trip? Bob seemed to think he was doing her a favor, cooking for himself and taking his clothes to the single, overused public laundry. Some year real soon now they'd get washing machines, but not yet. Bob seemed to think he was being big-hearted, not publicly getting jealous over her having a job that took her away from home with a male superior who was notoriously single. Bob seemed to think he was some kind of progressive, liberated man for putting up with a wife who had read Betty Friedan and didn't shave her armpits. Fuck you, Bob, she thinks tiredly, and tugs the heavy strap of the sample case over her shoulder and turns to head in John's direction. There'll be time to sort things out with Bob later. For now, she's got a job to do. John is leaning over the battered camera, peering through its viewfinder in search of...
something.
What's up? She asks.
Mock termites are up, he says very seriously. See the entrances? The mock termites are what they've come to take a look at. Nobody's reported on them from close up, but they're very visible as soon as you venture into the dusty plain. She peers at the foot of the termite mound, a baked clay hump in the soil that seems to writhe with life. There are little pipe-like holes, tunnels almost, emerging from the base of the mound, and little black mock termites dancing in and out of the holes in never-ending streams. Little is relative. They're almost as large as mice. Don't touch them, he warns. Are they poisonous? Asks Maddie.
Don't know. Don't want to find out this far from the hospital. The fact that there are no vertebrates here... He shrugs. We know they're poisonous to other insectoida.
Maddie puts the sample case down. But nobody's been bitten, or died, or anything.
Not that we know of.
He folds back the lid of the case and she shivers, abruptly cold, imagining bleached bones lying unburied in the long grass of the inland plain where no humans will live for centuries to come.
It's essential to take care out here. We could be missing for days before anyone noticed, and a search party wouldn't necessarily find us, even with the journey plan we filed.
Okay.
She watches as he takes out an empty sample jar and a label and carefully notes down time and date, distance and direction from the milestone at the heart of Fort Eisenhower. 36 miles. They might as well be on another planet. You're taking samples? He glances round.
Of course.
Then he reaches into the side pocket of the bag and removes a pair of heavy gloves, which he proceeds to put on, and a trowel.
If you could put the case down over there.
Maddie glances inside the case as he kneels down by the mock termite mound. It's full of jars with blank labels, neatly segregated, impassable quarantine zones for improbable species. She looks round. John is busy with the mock termite mound. He's neatly lopped the top off it. Inside, the earth is a squirming mass of... things. Black things, white things like bits of string, and a pulp of half-decayed vegetable matter that smells damply of humus. He probes the mound delicately with the trowel, seeking something.
Look! He calls over his shoulder. It's a queen!
Maddie hurries over.
Really?
She asks. Following his gloved finger, she sees something the size of her left forearm, white and glistening. It twitches, expelling something round, and she feels her gorge rise.
Ugh!
It's just a happy mother, John says calmly.
He lowers the trowel, works it in under the queen, and lifts her. And a collection of hangers-on, courtiers and bodyguards alike, over the jar. He tips, he shakes, and he twists the lid into place. Maddie stares at the chaos within. What is it like to be a mock termite, suddenly snatched up and transplanted to a mockery of home? What's it like to see the sun in an electric light bulb, to go about your business blindly pumping out eggs and eating and foraging for leaves, under the eyes of inscrutable collectors? She wonders if Bob would understand if she tried to tell him. John stands up and lowers the glass jar into the sample case, then freezes.
Ouch,
he says, and pulls his left glove off.
Ouch, he says again, more slowly. I missed a small one. Maddie, medical kit, please. Atropine and neostigmine.
She sees his eyes, pinprick pupils in the noonday glare, and dashes to the Land Rover. The medical kit, olive green with a red cross and a white circle, seems to mock her.
She rushes it over to John, who is now sitting calmly on the ground next to the sample case.
"What do you need?" she asks.
John tries to point, but his gloved hand is shaking wildly. He tries to pull it off, but the swollen muscles resist attempts to loosen the glove.
"Atropine."
A white cylinder with a red arrow on one side. She quickly reads the label, then pushes it hard against his thigh, feels something spring-loaded explode inside it. John stiffens, then tries to stand up, the automatic syringe still hanging from his leg. He staggers, stiff-legged, toward the Land Rover, and slumps into the passenger seat.
"Wait!"
she demands, tries to feel his wrist.
"How many of them bit you?"
His eyes roll.
"Just one. Silly of me. No vertebrates."
Then he leans back.
"I'm going to try and hold on. Your first aid training."
Maddie gets the glove off, exposing fingers like angry red sausages, but she can't find the wound on his left hand, can't find anything to suck the poison out of. John's breathing is laboured, and he twitches. He needs the hospital, but it's at least a 4-hour drive away, and she can't look after him while she drives. So she puts another syringe load of atropine into his leg and waits with him for 5 minutes while he struggles for breath hoarsely, then follows up with adrenaline and anything else she can think of that's good for handling anaphylactic shock.
"Get us back,"
he manages to wheeze at her between emphysemic gasps.
"Samples too."
After she gets him into the load bed of the truck, she dashes over to the mock termite mound with the spare petrol can. She splashes the best part of a gallon of fuel over the heap, coughing with the stink. She caps the jerry can, drags it away from the mound, then strikes a match and throws it flickering at the disordered insect kingdom. There's a soft whoomph as the igniting gas sets the mound aflame. Small shapes writhe and crisp beneath an empty blue sky, pierced by the glaring pinprick of S. Dorados. Maddie doesn't stay to watch. She hauls the heavy sample case back to the Land Rover, loads it into the truck alongside John, and scurries back toward town as fast as she can. She's almost 10 miles away before she remembers the camera, left staring in cyclopean isolation at the scorched remains of the dead colony. Homeward Bound. The big ground effect ship rumbles softly as it cruises across the endless expanse of the Dzerzhinsky Ocean at nearly 300 knots, homeward bound at last. Misha sits in his cubbyhole. A shipboard political officer, he rates an office of his own and sweats over his report with the aid of a glass of Polish pear schnapps. Radio can't punch through more than a few thousand miles of air directly, however powerful the transmitters. On Earth, they used to bounce signals off the ionosphere or the moon, but that doesn't work here. The other disks are too far away to use as relays. There's a chain of receiver boys marching out across the ocean at 2,000-kilometer intervals, but the equipment is a pig to maintain, very expensive to build, and nobody is even joking about stringing undersea cables across 1 million kilometers of seafloor. Misha's problem is that the expedition, himself included, is effectively stranded back in the 18th century without even the telegraph to tie civilization together, which is a pretty pickle to find yourself in when you're the bearer of news that will make the Politburo shit a brick. He desperately wants to be able to boost this up the ladder a bit, but instead it's going to be his name, and his alone, on the masthead.
"Bastards! Why couldn't they give us a signal rocket or two?"
He gulps back what's left of the schnapps, and winds a fresh sandwich of paper and carbon into his top-secret eyes-only typewriter.
"Because it would weigh too much, Misha,"
the captain says, right behind his left shoulder, causing him to jump and bang his head on the overhead locker. When Misha stops swearing and Gagarin stops chuckling, the party man carefully turns his stack of typescript face down on the desk, then politely gestures the captain into his office.
What can I do for you, boss? And what do you mean they're too heavy?
Gargarin shrugs. We looked into it.
Sure, we could put a tape recorder and transmitter into an ICBM and shoot it up to 20,000 kilometers.
Trouble is, it'd fall down again in an hour or so.
The fastest we could squirt the message, it would cost about 1,000 rubles a character.
More to the point, even a lightweight rocket would weigh as much as our entire payload. Maybe in 10 years.
He sits down. How are you doing with that report?
Misha sighs.
How am I going to explain to Brezhnev that the Americans aren't the only mad bastards with hydrogen bombs out here? That we found the new world? And the new world is just like the old world, except it glows in the dark. And the only communists we've found so far are termites with guns.
For a moment he looks haggard.
It's been nice knowing you, Yuri.
Come on, it can't be that bad.
Gargarin's normally sunny disposition is clouded.
You try and figure out how to break the news to them.
After identifying the first set of ruins, they'd sent one of their MiGs out, loaded with camera pods and fuel. 1,000 kilometers inland, it had seen the same ominous story of nuclear annihilation visited on an alien civilization. Ruins of airports, railroads, cities, factories. A familiar topography in unfamiliar form.
This was New York.
Once, thousands of years before a giant stamped the bottom of Manhattan Island into the seabed. And that was once Washington, D.C. Sure, there'd been extra skyscrapers, but they'd hardly needed the subsequent coastal cruise to be sure that what they were looking at was the same continent as the old capitalist enemy, thousands of years and 1,000,000 kilometers beyond a nuclear war.
We are running away like a dog that's seen the devil ride out, hoping that he doesn't spot us and follow us home for a new winter hat.
Gargarin frowns. Excuse me? He points to the bottle of pear schnapps.
You are my guest.
Misha pours the first cosmonaut a glass, then tops up his own.
It opens certain ideological conflicts, Yuri. And nobody wants to be the bearer of bad news.
Ideological? Such as?
Ah.
Misha takes a mouthful.
Well, we have so far avoided nuclear annihilation and invasion by the forces of reactionary terror during the Great Patriotic War, but only by the skin of our teeth. Now doctrine has it that any alien species advanced enough to travel in space is almost certain to have discovered socialism, if not true communism, no? And that the enemies of socialism wish to destroy socialism and take its resources for themselves.
But what we've seen here is evidence of a different sort. This was America. It follows that somewhere nearby there is a continent that was home to another Soviet Union 2,000 years ago. But this America has been wiped out, and our elder Soviet brethren are not in evidence, and they have not colonized this other America. What can this mean?
Gargarin's brow wrinkled.
They're dead, too.
I mean that the alternative Americans wiped them out in an act of colonialist, imperialist aggression, but did not survive their treachery, he adds hastily.
Misha's lips quirk in something approaching a grin. Better work on getting your terminology right the first time, before you see Brezhnev, comrade, he says. Yes, you are correct on the facts, but there are matters of interpretation to consider. No colonial exploitation has occurred. So either the perpetrators were also wiped out, or perhaps, well, it opens up several very dangerous avenues of thought. Because if new Soviet man isn't home hereabouts, it implies that something happened to them, doesn't it? Where are all the true communists? If it turns out that they ran into hostile aliens, then, well, theory says that aliens should be good brother socialists.
Theory and 10 rubles will buy you a bottle of vodka on this one.
Something is badly wrong with our understanding of the direction of history.
I suppose there's no question that there's something we don't know about, Gargarin adds in the ensuing silence, almost as an afterthought.
Yes, and that's a fig leaf of uncertainty we can hide behind, I hope.
Misha puts his glass down and stretches his arms behind his head, fingers interlaced until his knuckles crackle.
Before we left, our agents reported signals picked up in America from...
Damn. I should not be telling you this without authorization. Pretend I said nothing.
His frown returns.
You sound as if you're having dismal thoughts.
Gargarin prods.
I am having dismal thoughts, Comrade Colonel General. Very dismal thoughts indeed. We have been behaving as if this world we occupy is merely a new geopolitical game board, have we not? Secure in the knowledge that brother socialists from beyond the stars brought us here to save us from the folly of the imperialist aggressors, or that anyone else we meet will be either barbarians or good communists. We have fallen into the pattern of an earlier age, expanding in all directions, recognizing no limits, assuming our manifest destiny.
But what if there are limits? Not a barbed wire fence or a line in the sand, but something more subtle. Why does history demand success of us? What we know is the right way for humans on a human world, with an industrial society to live. But this is not a human world. And what if it's a world in which we're not destined to succeed? Or what if the very circumstances that gave rise to Marxism are themselves transient in the broader scale? What if there is a, you'll pardon me, a materialist god? We know this is our own far future we are living in. Why would any power vast enough to build this disk bring us here?
Gargarin shakes his head. There are no limits, my friend, he says, a trifle condescendingly. If there were, do you think we would have gotten this far?
Misha thumps his desk angrily.
Why do you think they put us somewhere where your precious rockets don't work? He demands. Get up on high, one push of rocket exhaust, and you could be halfway to anywhere. But down here, we have to slog through the atmosphere. We can't get away. Does that sound like a gift from one friend to another?
The way you're thinking sounds paranoid to me, Gargarin insists. I'm not saying you're wrong, mind you. Only, could you be overwrought? Finding those bombed cities affected us all, I think.
Misha glances out of his airliner-sized porthole.
I fear there's more to it than that. We're not unique, comrade. We've been here before. And we all died.
We're a fucking duplicate, Yuri Alexeyevich. There's a larger context to all this. And I'm scared by what the Politburo will decide to do when they see the evidence. Or what the Americans will do.